Welcome to the Big Mike Fund Podcast, where you learn about advanced wealth building strategies from real estate investing to creating massive ROI and secured retirement profits. So pour yourself a cup of coffee, grab a notepad, and lean in, because Big Mike has got the mic, starting now.
Welcome to the Big Mike Fund Podcast. I'm the Big Mike. Today's episode is going to be a monologue. It's going to be a discussion on real estate investment opportunities and risks in 2018. I prepared a presentation for this. I'm going to walk through the slides. And if you're just listening to this, hopefully you'll enjoy it in audio mode only. Ideally, this is going to be designed for visual presentation. We will post this presentation in video mode, going through slides. This is just for better understanding of the content. Once again, I'm Mike Zlatnik, CEO of TF Management Group, and I run the Big Mike Fund Podcast. Disclaimer, this presentation is only for educational purposes only. It is not an attempt to sell securities or sell anything else. It is not providing legal, accounting, or any other advice. The presenter is in the private lending fund management business, and the opinion presented are for educational purposes only. Prior to making any decisions, please consult your professional attorney or financial advisor. Investments in the Tampa Opportunity Fund, as I'll talk a little bit about it, or TF Investment Fund 2 are offered through private placement memorandum to accredited investors only. Please request a copy if you have any interest in those funds. And please consult your investment professional before making any decisions. This was a disclaimer. A couple of words about us. So TF Management Group was founded in 2014. Currently, it manages two funds, TF Investment Fund 2, which was started in 2014, and Tampa Opportunity Fund, which was started in 2017. It's 1 year old. It is managed by me and Yuri Novodvorsky. We have combined over 25 years of real estate experience, strong operational management background. I've been in the fund management business since 2009. We specialize in two lines of business, short-term bridge hard money loans for fix and flip projects. That's our meat and potatoes business. We've also expanded quite significantly in the long-term equity investments focused on predictable cash flow, value-add-driven appreciation. So let me talk a little bit about investing versus speculating. I'm starting from this angle because I wanted to differentiate for the audience what's the difference. So Benjamin Graham said that investment operation is one which, on thorough analysis, promises safety of the principal and a satisfactory return. Operations not meeting these requirements are speculative. Benjamin Graham is very focused on safety of the investment and a reasonable rate of return, and things that are outside of that are speculative in nature. There's been a lot of speculation in financial markets. Focusing on speculative investments has been a play, but I wanted to make sure the audience understands the difference. There's investing and there's speculation. And many investments are called speculative. They're essentially, in a matter of speaking, gambling. They could do very well or they can be very poor. While investing is a more conservative fundamental approach that creates a degree of safety for the principal and a reasonable rate of return for the capital. So return of investment, rule number one is return of capital, and rule number two, return on capital. So total return. The total return is composed of typically two components. Component number one of total return is return on investment, and the component number two of total return is return of time. This is a vitally important concept. Many investors don't pay attention to the return on time. They make an investment that requires their active involvement, their time and energy, and they don't generate great return on time. They often completely forget about it, and then they wind up spending a lot of time, and they think they got a great return on investment. In fact, they got a potentially real poorer return on the investment, but a reasonable return on that time, or vice versa. The return on investment was good, but the return on that time was terrible. So would you rather take an investment of $100,000 that generates $20,000 a year, but it takes 100 hours of your time to manage? Or would you take $12,000 per year, but takes none of your time? This question demonstrates the difference. I would rather take personally a passive investment that generates me 12% return on investment than a very active one that generates 20%. It really varies case by case. At times, it's better to take an active investment, but the return on time in this case doesn't justify higher return in my view, but it is really a function of how much your time is worth. So this is a very important subject. I hope you understand. Let me continue. There are two elements to the return on investment. Number one, it's cash on cash return. And number two, it is appreciation. So cash on cash return is what you get out of the investment on a regular basis. If you make a loan and you get interest, that's the cash on cash that you receive. If you invest in a property and borrow money via a mortgage and you receive a cash flow after all the expenses and a mortgage payment, that's your cash on cash return. Now, if you're an equity owner of a property, generally speaking, benefit from the appreciation. So appreciation is the second element of the return. There are two types of appreciation. There's a natural appreciation, and then there is a forced appreciation. And there's a huge difference. So natural appreciation comes as a tide that raises all boats. And that is something you sort of get for free. There is nothing you have to do about it. It just happens. Forced appreciation is a result of your work or somebody else's work improving a given property through redevelopment, renovations, improvements, and so on. There's a third element to the return on investment. It is sort of a pseudo-benefit, as it does improve a cash flow, but it is not necessarily something that is permanent. So it is depreciation. So depreciation is a tax benefit. So an investment could have depreciation or accelerated depreciation that effectively neutralizes the cash flow and removes tax liabilities. However, depreciation is not completely free. Depreciation needs to be recaptured someday upon a sale. But it is a benefit in the short run, and it does help cash flowing projects. Let me talk a little bit about investment strategies. And again, I'm using the word investment, not speculation, because these type of things are generally thought of investments. So number one, there's investments for growth. And some investments for growth do fall in the speculative investment category. There are also investments for income. Typically, investments for income are considered to be less speculative and more investment-like, but not necessarily the case. I'll give you some examples. And there are investments for growth and income. So in my view, there are really only three categories: growth, income, and growth and income. So income investments maximize risk-adjusted cash flow, expecting generally minimal or no appreciation. That's a general definition of that category. Growth investments, they maximize risk-adjusted appreciation via value add, renovations, improvements, redevelopment, and such. And growth investments typically don't care much about income. And then there are growth and income investments. So growth and income investments, they maximize risk-adjusted appreciation via value add and cash flow. Balancing act of having good cash flow and strong appreciation. That's the focus of the growth and income investments. I hope you can understand the difference. So let's talk a little bit about market conditions today, because we're looking at the current markets and the opportunities in 2018. So economically, we are at the peak of the economic expansion. We are sort of at the peak of the cycle. And given past history and given the laws of economics, and I call it the laws of gravity, slowdown is inevitable. most likely we will see it. It might not happen fast. This expansion cycle has been particularly long, and it is not a typical expansion cycle. But the chances are there will be a correction, there will be a level of recession, because most developed economies operate that this way. Let's look at the most asset classes. And most asset classes are fully priced or possibly overpriced. We need to be careful because the market determines the price. It is very possible that many assets will continue to appreciate. But they've had such a great run, and the earnings relative to the assets themselves have not caught up. This can be seen in stock market as PEs have gotten to the point of, I would say, a very high stratosphere. So any further appreciation would have to be justified by growing earnings. If assets don't produce more income or earnings, it is unlikely they'll continue to appreciate at the same rate as in the past or at all. Cap rates in real estate, that's a term used. And a cap rate is simply a rate of return on your investment without calculation of a debt service. So if you own an asset and that generates you $100,000 in income, and the operating expenses are $40,000, and the net operating income is $60,000, you divide that by the cost of the asset, say $1 million. So you divide $60,000 by $1 million, and you come up with a cap rate of 6%. So cap rates are historically low. What does that mean? That means that investors have been paying top prices for the same level of income, and that compression of the cap rates is a risk zone. So we are at historically low cap rates, and I believe that's an indication of potential peak of the market. It's not true for every asset class. There are, as you'll see in a minute, certain subclasses of real estate that are trading at a very attractive cap rates, but it's a very contrarian play. We'll talk about this in a couple of minutes. Let's look at the interest rates. The interest rates have been moving up, and they will likely continue to rise. I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know at which point they peak out. I do believe that there will be some level of slowdown in the interest rate increases. Probably this year we'll see one or two more increases, and then it'll probably peak out. So we're not looking at the major interest rate increases, but they're still going up. And typically, as rates go up, they do negatively impact all asset classes, including the stock market. Why? Because interest rate increases typically follow inflation. And Fed has a dual mandate, has a mandate to keep economy at full employment, and we are at that level as unemployment is very low. And the second mandate is to fight inflation. The reason Fed has been raising rates, it is because they've met the mandate number one, and now they're meeting the mandate number two as inflation is heating up. And why inflation is bad for stocks is because of the wage inflation element. As wages climb with low unemployment, it hurts corporate earnings. And as a result, it'll put negative pressure on stock prices. The next area of very interesting, it's a fear and an opportunity. When there is a fear, there's an opportunity. So there's a fear of Amazon. Amazon has been eating everybody's lunch. They've been delivering everything from the diapers to food to books. So that's the original business. They're delivering everything, and many department stores have been closing down. And that's, again, an area of opportunity because it creates real estate that can be used for higher and better use than the department stores. The economy is shifting. So Amazon effect is permanent. It is here to stay. And people change their habits. They enjoy deliveries a lot more than going to a mall. But malls are no longer the same as in the past. They're transforming. And this shopping experience is an area of opportunity because there's a strong fear of Amazon. And Amazon effect is causing cap rates to be historically high on many of the retail properties. So we'll talk about that as a contrarian play. But let's continue. There's heavy construction of the residential housing units, and that has been a norm for the last few years, and it continues to be, and the market is particularly hot for entry-level residential housing. We appear to be in the significant undersupply of those units, and the construction is full steam ahead. And those entry-level, first-time home buyer type of properties are trading at a great price for developers. The unemployment is low, but the incomes are on the rise. I already mentioned this. Inflation is picking up, and this will have an economic impact on stock prices. Let us continue. That's the market conditions today. So we'll talk about various types of opportunity. The first type of opportunity we're going to talk about is the momentum play opportunities. They exist in every market. The expression is the trend is your friend, and it is a trend. And as I mentioned just a couple of sentences earlier, the new housing development, single-family townhouses, condos, is a very hot sector of the market, specifically entry-level. That subcomponent of the market is doing very well, and when you invest in that sector today, you're still playing the momentum. There's another sector of the market that has significantly slowed down or is slowing down depending where you're at. That is the high end of the market. The high end of the market, I'll give you an example. I live in New York City, and the high end of the market is considered to be condominiums priced at $5 million or more. And New York City has, believe it or not, 5 years of supply for condos over $5 million. All it means is that it would take 5 years to sell current inventory, even if no more high-end condos were developed. It's a significant slowdown factor, and the prices for that high-end inventory have been going down in New York. I don't know the exact statistics. I've heard from different sources, anywhere from 10 to 20%. Also, the flood of the high-end condos has put downward pressure on rental prices in that high-end market space as well, as more inventory is available. Another interesting subsector of the momentum play is some level of multifamily retail commercial assumable mortgages. I've come across opportunities in that space, and properties with assumable mortgages with great low rates that are locked for a long period of time is a phenomenal asset. And buying those properties could be very attractive. The primary driver is to pick them up with fixed rate mortgages, assumable mortgages, and be able to increase rents through renovation or just general demographics and area improvement. So those type of properties also are in the momentum space. Let's look at the turnkey rental space. So that space has been hot for a number of years, but it is slowing down. The reason it is slowing down is because the yields, the return, cash on cash return, are at a point where they are less attractive. And the reason it has happened is because the prices have appreciated. As the prices have gone up, the rents have not kept up with the price increases. And the cost of financing has gone up. So generally speaking, the yield, cash on cash yield in turnkey space have come down simply because the prices have appreciated and cost of financing have gone up while the rents have been flat or slightly increasing. Another area of momentum play is land purchases in cities, infill, for the development and redevelopment, especially land that is zoned for good vertical development. That type of land has been hot and continues to be very hot because of the momentum play in the condo development space or single family or townhouses. So these are the opportunities in the momentum space. Let me give you an example of momentum deal we're working on right now. And it's a very straightforward deal. It's an infill development in Jacksonville, Florida, of 9 townhouses. The project looks fairly attractive. So all in between the land and construction, the project sponsor is likely to spend about a million to a million one, and the approximate resale value of the 9 properties is between 1.5 to 1.6 million. That's a pretty healthy upside, and these are straightforward type of development. They're townhouses, entry level, that they generally speaking sell like hotcakes. The investor is putting in that deal $300,000 to $400,000. We're likely going to fund $600,000 to $800,000 alone, and the project has 6 to 12 months duration. And what I like very much about this particular deal is that the investor has two exit strategies. Number one, the investor could refi via traditional bank upon completion of his units, and the secondary strategy could sell individual houses. So this is a good momentum play type of a deal. Now let's talk a little bit about a different type of opportunity called value add. So value add opportunities everywhere. We invest into a lot of value add opportunities. We love value add space because this is a space where you can make good profits and have safety because you're creating equity cushion, you're improving cash flow. So let's talk a little bit about what type of value adds are out there. Let's start with multifamily. So multifamily value adds typically include unit upgrades, renovations of the kitchen, appliances, flooring, repainting, fixtures, and so on and so forth. In addition to that, there are common area improvements such as hallways, laundry facilities, clubhouses, gym, all those elements can create higher demand for the units, make units more appealing, and units could support higher rents. So these things increase occupancies, they increase rent, and then they create additional income streams. Next area of value add opportunity is something that I briefly mentioned. It's redevelopment. And often redevelopment comes from the old retail centers or old malls that have been taken out of business by Amazon and newer, more experience-oriented type of shopping centers and malls. So older malls are sitting within cities, empty, sometimes in prime location, but they don't have the ability to act as a retail center. So often these type of properties could be redeveloped. We have an investment, I'll give you an example, into a redevelopment of a Macy's in Cleveland, Ohio area, into a self-storage facility with a little bit of retail space. So the primary focus is to take old Macy's, redevelop into Class A self-storage in an area where there's a significant shortage of self-storage because there is no free land to build, and historically it's been undersupplied in that area. So that conversion creates an interesting opportunity. There are also conversions in the industrial warehouse and commercial spaces. I've looked at some projects where old warehouses have been renovated and improved and have become distribution centers for national retailers, could be Amazon, could be other ones, and many current stores act as distribution centers as well. The next area of momentum play is ground-up development, and there are a few subsectors in that market. So let me start with back to the self-storage. Why self-storage? Because self-storage is typically resistant to recession. And today, there is decent probability of economy slowing down and going in the recession, and self-storage facilities do well in general during the down cycle. There's also ground-up development of commercial and industrial, especially in the areas where it has been underdeveloped, and obviously residential. As I mentioned earlier, residential has been very hot. So let me give you an example of a value-add project we have invested into. We have invested in a project in Chicago, Illinois area. It's a 344-unit multifamily complex. It was acquired for $45 million, roughly. There's a great first lien mortgage. It's a Freddie Mac mortgage on the property with a rate of 3.09%. The rate is phenomenal. It was obtained before Trump got elected, before the rate spiked. And that deal has $12 million syndicated equity. We participated in that syndication as a limited partner. The project has strong value add, and the value add is unit renovations, common area improvements, construction of the clubhouse, and rent increases upon renewal. And the project sponsor has been successful to increase rents approximately 19% on average for a unit in comparison non-renovated to renovated unit. It's a very significant increase. The area supports higher rents. And ultimately, as renovations complete and the property now performs at a whole new level, the value of this asset is likely going to increase to $65 million from $45. So as you could see, the value add creates a significant equity buffer. It's a forced appreciation play. The projected internal rate of return on that investment is in the mid-20% for the LPs in that project, which is a very strong. So the project does cash flow as it's going through renovation and has a significant pop on the back end when the property is sold. And even if it is not sold, the cash flow will increase quite a bit and it'll become, it's called a cash monster, even if the property is not sold. So these type of assets, they are great in any kind of a market. Even if the asset prices will contract, the cash flow is the king. So cash flow from a project like that will take care of whatever risks associated with the interest rate increases and market correction. Now let's talk about the next level of opportunities is a contrarian play. So contrarian plays in today's market are not easy to find, but there is one sector that's a pure contrarian play. I believe there are all kinds of interesting opportunities and we are investing in them. So simply speaking, it is retail opportunities that REITs are selling while we look at them and we are buying them. Why? Why that area is an area of opportunity? Well, Amazon effect is scaring many players in the market. And the reason they're scared is because their stock has been depressed, REITs have been beaten up, they do need liquidity for their newer projects, they have difficult time raising capital in the markets because the sector is sort of in a psychological retreat space. It's just simply the fact that big players just are concerned that this space doesn't present a strong upside because Amazon can continue to eat their lunch. We look at the glass as half full instead of half empty. So there are plenty of service and experience-oriented shopping centers. And these type of centers are trading at a great cap rates. We're often entering into this project at the cap rates of 9 or better, which is sort of historically high for this type of property. The cost of reconstruction is a whole lot higher than the sales price. And many of these centers could undergo some level of tenant change with a focus on services and experiences. And suddenly they could become great centers instead of all department stores. So as I mentioned, some opportunities exist in the redevelopment of the old department stores into self-storage facilities. There are also plenty of existing plays where there is no heavy lifting. It's just an acquisition at a great price with great financing, generating strong cash-on-cash return. So we've invested in the projects that have initial going in cash and cash return in the 11 to 16% range. And on top of that, these projects have very good value adds. They have out parcels that could be developed or redeveloped or sold. They could have occupancy increase plays so that they're not occupied to the normal capacity, so they're trading at, say, 85 to 90% occupancy, where they could be 90 to 95%. So there's room to improve there and significantly improve the cash flow. There's also tenant mix change. So instead of small department stores, there could be restaurants, there could be medical facilities, there could be daycare centers. Anything service oriented needs a good location. And some of these malls are very well located. So change of tenant mix, lease up, could create a significant upside opportunity. So the primary benefits are typically strong cash flow, development or sale, development and sale of some of the out parcels. Typically, there are standalone restaurants on a property. It could be McDonald's, it could be Burger King, or many other standalone, could be Dunkin' Donuts. They're part of the real estate, but they could be sold as a standalone properties. And the cap rates on those could be significantly lower, generating significant upside for those assets. And then the tenant changes and lease up can generate additional upside for these properties. There's still risk of Amazon effect, but that's why it's called a contrarian play. You either can be scared and stay out of it, or you could look and you could see the opportunity. So let me give you an example of a contrarian deal. We've invested in the service-oriented shopping plaza in Augusta, Georgia. It has very strong cash flow. It has projected cash flow between actually 12 and 20% range, depending on how the project goes, but it started very, very strongly. And it has an average cash flow in the 13 to 15% range for the first 5 to 7 years. That alone can compensate for any risk associated with potential asset price degradation. That property had a great assumable mortgage. As I mentioned, it's both a momentum play and a contrarian play. And rents are below the market. And that kind of creates a downside protection. If there's some level of recession, those tenants are likely to stay because the rents are below the market. It has great long-term leases. It has upside on 3 out parcels. And it's got a great location, strong traffic and visibility. So from that perspective, this is a phenomenal investment. It does have some Amazon risk, but we believe the risk is fairly limited given the composition of the tenants and focus on service. As you make investments, or you have already made them, you should understand your risks and manage them and mitigate them. So I'm going to talk a little bit about a few things that investors should consider doing in this market. So number one, and this is true in every situation, you can't go wrong by doing this. The advice is to diversify. That's the number one risk mitigation strategy. Now let's talk a little bit about specific risks and how to manage them. Number one risk is interest rate increases. So as interest rates increase, the cost of financing becomes more expensive. So what do you do today if you're expecting the interest rates to increase? If you haven't done so, you should consider refinancing, locking in long-term rates, and that becomes a safety element, becomes a predictability of performance. And the second way to mitigate high interest rates, rates is to reduce leverage. So instead of borrowing 75% loan to value, borrow 70. That 5% reduction in the mortgage amount does two things. Number one, the bank looks at it, they are taking less risk on the loan. Therefore, they can afford somewhat lower interest rates. So it compounds the effect. Not only you could take less risk, but you also could reduce the rates because you are approaching the bank and you are able to reduce their risk. So by reducing the risk for the bank, you can obtain better cost of financing. And as a consequence, your cash flow will improve. That's a very powerful technique. I've seen it used many times. I've used it myself before, and I strongly recommend reduce leverage, and that will significantly help your negotiations with the bank. Some cases it won't make a difference, some cases can make a significant difference, especially if you're dropping from, say, 75% loan to value to, say, 65 or even 60. That alone can make huge difference. There could be a difference in the rate from anywhere from 50 basis points and more. Let's take a look at another element of risk. Let's just say asset prices start going down. And that happens when the interest rates rise on commercial properties. So what do you do? Well, at that point, focus on cash flow. Don't worry about fair market value. So if your investments are focused on cash flow, you really don't care what happens to the going prices. Your cash flow is what you see in the bank. That's allows you to survive any downturn. And so that's the strategy number one. Strategy number two, invest in the projects that have multiple exit strategies. And what that means is that not only you could sell an asset potentially, but you can refinance an asset. So if you are doing a development, so let's use an example of single family housing. When you develop a property that is very affordable, and you can either sell it or you could refinance it and decide to keep it and rent it out. So dual exit strategy enables you to mitigate risk and create a downside protection. The next strategy is to invest in the recession-resistant sectors. As I mentioned before, self-storage is a recession-resistant sector. Another example is affordable housing. So affordable housing, people need to live somewhere. So you can always rent these properties. And if it's a recession, that sector seems to do fairly well, as people can just not live somewhere. They need shelter. They can go less to malls. They can go less to restaurants. They can spend less, but they still need to live. So now let me talk about best advice ever. People have asked me, what is your best advice ever? The best advice ever is diversify, diversify, diversify. Next to that would be focus on cash flow, as we talked about this. And also focus on areas of lower volatility and higher predictability. So you could do that by simply looking at your investment opportunities, understanding what is likely to perform predictably and what is likely to be highly speculative. The next level of advice, as I mentioned in the previous couple of slides, is use smart conservative leverage, reduce leverage. By reducing leverage, you're reducing risk for your lenders, and you are likely going to get better financing terms. You're also reducing the risk for yourself, because if you have higher vacancy, you can, in fact, sustain it with lower mortgage payments. Ultimately, at the end of the day, it's all about risk-adjusted return. Not just a return, but risk-adjusted return. So take less risk, and your return, believe it or not, is likely going to improve. Let me talk a little bit about comparison between investing in individual deals or investing in the funds. So this podcast and my whole area of expertise is all about funds. I'm a fund manager. I love being a fund manager, very passionate about it. But we also do individual deals. And I know many investors who invest in individual deals. And I wanted to point out this fundamental differences between individual deal investing and fund investing. So number one, when you invest in the individual deal, you have high risk concentration and high volatility, because the one project has all your capital. And if it does well, you could do phenomenally well. But if it does poorly, you have a lot of risk concentration there. Compare that to a fund. On a fund level, the fund diversifies between many assets. So when you invest in a fund, you have better diversification and lower volatility. Let's talk about liquidity now. So on an individual deal level, generally speaking, liquidity is low. If you bought an asset with a mortgage or not, you put all your eggs in one basket. Do you have liquidity at that point? The chances are no. You get your cash flow, but your liquidity comes from a sale of an asset or refinancing. But if you just enter the asset, you can't easily get out. And if you got out, you have transaction cost and likely going to lose money. So individual deals have that low liquidity characteristics in general. The funds in general have better liquidity because funds have liquidity coming from three sources. Number one, funds raise capital. Number two, funds receive income. Number three, funds have investments that sell and repay back. So funds liquidity is generally better. It varies by fund. Some funds don't have liquidity because they're long-term and they have they don't raise capital, nor do we sell assets. Those funds are very different. We have much better liquidity because we make loans in hard money space. A lot of loans come back. We continue to raise capital and we receive good operating income. So we maintain high liquidity. Some funds don't. You should know the difference. Now let's compare individual deals and funds on a personal guarantee level. So when you go to a bank to get a mortgage for your property, if it's an investment, single family residential, the chances are the bank will require a personal guarantee. Many single assets do require a guarantee from the sponsor, not all of them, but it might be required. When we invest as a fund into any deal, we never, never invest into any deal that requires a personal guarantee. We simply will not participate in that. We often participate as limited partners instead of general partners. The general partner might be required to sign personal guarantee, but we never are. Another interesting comparison point is potential liability risk. So when you invest into individual deal, you have potential liability. You own the asset, even if you own it through a limited liability company. You could be held responsible for negligence. And as I mentioned, you could be signing personal guarantee on the mortgage. So there's a little bit more risk for potential liability. When we invest as a fund, the fund is a passive investor. It never acts in an operating capacity. So the liability associated with that doesn't exist for the fund. It does have some liability risks like anything else, but it's a much lower level than typically an individual takes operating a property. Also, individual investments require more active investment and more personal time. When you invest in a fund, you're completely passive and it's a passive income to you. It doesn't require any personal time. There's another difference between investing into individual deals and investing in a fund. So if you look from a fund deployment perspective, you often have a gap between your investments. Say you invested in a given deal and the deal repaid back. If it was a loan or you had an asset and you sold the asset. At that point, you have cash back in your bank and it's sitting idle and earning you nothing. And you got to go look for another investment. If you invest in a fund, the funds are always working. Depending on the type of a fund, you may be earning at the very minimum preferred return. And fund managers do worry about fund utilization. I, as a fund manager, always am thinking about how to deploy capital to get the funds working in an optimal capacity. So as an investor, you have significant benefits in a fund investment versus individual deal from a capital deployment perspective. The next area of comparison is when you're investing in individual deal, you must have the right amount of dollars, right amount of capital. Why? Because the deal requires $100,000 and you only have $50,000. That's a problem. You can't do the deal. You need to find partners. So that's the challenge of individual deal. You got to have enough capital or the right amount of capital. If you have too much capital, you can't deploy it either. You found the deal for $100,000. You have $200,000 in the bank. What do you do with the rest of the money? You got to find another deal. If you compare that to a fund, it's much more flexible. You can come to us or any other fund and say, what's your minimum investment? Let's just say $100,000. And you can essentially invest any amount of money. If you have $200,000, you can invest $200,000. Even if you have less than the minimal amount, you can ask the fund manager if they'll consider making an exception and allow you to come in with less capital than the minimum. So it's a lot more flexible when you're making investment in a fund than an individual deal. But I wanted to compare those two. Let me say a couple of words about Tempo Opportunity Fund LLC. It's our flagship fund. We launched it, we raised the first round of capital in April of 2017. We've had essentially a full year of operation, and it's been a good run for us. So very happy to talk about that. So the fund focus, we are focused on value-add equity investments, and we're also focused on fix and flip hard money loans. Those are two main lines of our business. The fund does have preferred return of 7%, and then the total target return is 10 to 13%. It is a projected number on a long-term basis. Our recent history is significantly better than that, but I'm saying that with a significant disclaimer. The past results do not guarantee future performance. Future performance can be different. So our trailing 12 months total return on the A units as of April 1st, 2018, was 22.14%, and C units, 17.60%. This is far above the target range, and I wanted to, again, disclaim that the numbers may not be as good in the future. The most recent quarter has been a lot more in line with the recent results. So the recent quarter finished April 1st, 2018. A units generated on annualized basis, these returns are on annualized basis. So A units generated 11.27%, B units 10.76%, and C units generated 9.09%. So these returns are much more reasonable, but they're still very solid returns. And as a fund manager, we're focused on long-term performance, not single quarterly results. On a fund capital level, we went from zero to 7.7 million, a little bit more, 7.74 million as of April 1st. So I'm very pleased with that level of capital raising, and we continue to raise capital at a good pace. And the fund distributes income quarterly. So quarterly distributions can be taken in the form of a check or a wire or a payment, or distributions can be reinvested. That's about it. I am at your service. If you're interested to speak with me, if you have any questions, I am available. So let me talk a couple of words. So you already know about the podcast. You're listening to the podcast. So it's a bigmikefund.com podcast. Our website is tempofunding.com. I could be reached at mike@tempofunding.com. And that's probably the best way to get a hold of me. I do have a book out, and I am very passionate about the book. The book is called How to Choose a Smart Real Estate Investment Fund. And the book raises top 10 questions any investor should ask before investing in a fund. This is applicable to any kind of real estate fund. It is applicable to big REITs, or it's applicable to small funds like ours. The book is available on Amazon.com. Just search for How to Choose a Smart Real Investment Fund, or just search for my name, Mike Zlotnik, as an offer. And it is available free on Kindle. If you want a hard copy, it's $7.95 for a physical copy shipping. That is it. I appreciate your time. And if you have any questions, please reach out to me, mike@tempofunding.com. I'm delighted to be at your service. Thank you for your time and energy listening to my podcast. Have a great day.
Thank you for listening to the Big Mike Fund Podcast. To receive your copy of Mike's How to Choose a Smart Real Estate Fund book, head to bigmikefund.com or visit Amazon and type Mike Zlotnik. Keep listening and keep investing Big Mike style. See you on the next episode.